Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 178. Guys, we have a bunch of live shows coming up. Please come out and support them. I know someone hit me to the notion that people have been complaining on message threads outside of the Nerdist Podcast. AV Club! That, how come I have to sit through that bullshit at the beginning of the podcast where Chris just promotes stuff? I want you to know that I do believe your time is valuable, so I don't want you to think that I'm just trying to monopolize it by making you listen to stuff that I think you should know about. This is really so that we can always keep the podcast free, so don't think that I'm taking advantage of you. I just we want to promote stuff because our live shows help supplement, you know, all the stuff that we do at Nerdist Industries, and the sponsorships help us keep the podcast network going, really, so that they can always be free to you. So just know that I know that it is an investment of your time, but it's never more than like 3-ish minutes. So if you can sit through that, then I greatly thank you, and I appreciate that. That's our little exchange, I suppose. That's our dirty, dirty back alley exchange for the podcast. Hey, you want to listen to a podcast? Let me tell you about stuff for 3 minutes. Like Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. You can get a free trial, 15% off your new account for 6 months if you go to squarespace.com and use the offer code NERDIST3. It's an easy-to-use UI for creating and managing a website or blog for beginners, CSS experts, any level of skill that you have for building websites. Hundreds of design templates to choose from, and there's an iPhone, an iPad, and Android app available to update your blog on the go. Online resources and special support team give you personal help 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And now Squarespace offers free live classes to help all level of experience. Just check out those classes at workshops.squarespace.com. So for your free trial, sign up for your free account, no credit card needed, just try it out and start building your website. Then if you decide to purchase, use the offer code NERDIST3 and get 15% off for 6 months. That's squarespace.com, use the offer code NERDIST3. And now this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Oh my god, this is one of the ones that I had been wanting forever, and I never knew how it was going to happen because I had never really met these guys, the Johns. And then it finally just all worked out. I went up to perform. We went to do our podcast at SF Sketchfest, and I kind of branched off and went up to Santa Cruz and saw Jonathan Colton open for They Might Be Giants. And I got to talk to John and John before the show, right after their sound check. And then we got a song. If you stick around, there's a song from their sound check, from their new album, which I thoroughly recommend you pick up. It came out last year. It's called Join Us, and is available now wherever you buy digital or in your hands music. So here we go, the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 178, with two of my friggin' idols, John Linnell and John Flansburgh. They Might Be Giants. They might also be really nice, which they were.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
That sounds all right. I'm no sound engineer, but I'm picking up sound.
If you can hear sound.
I like the design of this thing. It's very pretty.
Yeah, it shoots out sort of a triangulation of, it'll blanket the room.
Sure.
If you're in this here. And it usually sounds pretty good.
Does it make things, does it sound really roomy?
It sounds roomy right now, yeah.
Should we? Is that good for your purposes?
I think it's okay.
Or should we get cozier to it somehow?
Just all
huddled.
Right, like like the Andrews.
I've just had some coffee.
I think it'll be fine.
I hope you had some too.
I think it'll be fine. We are in Santa Cruz. I'm recording, by the way. I just started.
That's fine.
Recording.
Yep.
I am so fascinated by Santa Cruz. It is relatively untouched by time.
But wait, are you from here?
No.
You're from Los Angeles,
yes,
right?
Yes, I live in L.A., and I was in downtown Santa Cruz. No chain stores. The most recent chain store was a Gap. Everything else locally owned.
Right. Wow. You know, a few years ago, we did a rock festival way, way upstate New York called Modown, which is like organized by the band Mo, which is like one of these jam bands.
Yeah.
And it was a really interesting sort of challenge to just play for... Well, they're, you know, those audiences really are in, they're really into improvising, obviously, but they're also really into sort of like, you know, organized musical chaos kind of ideas. And that was a nice crossover for us. But when you look at the crowd, there'll be, you know, thousands and thousands of people, and there are no logos on of the shirts, which is it's this very subtle thing that might not even think you would notice. But when you actually see a crowd where there's nobody wearing like the Old Navy shirt or the Pearl Jam shirt or the whatever shirt. It's actually really kind of notable.
And if they're wearing like a Loverboy shirt, they didn't pay $200 for it in a fashion store. They actually are the original owner.
They don't believe. I mean, culturally, it's a group of people who seem to actually not to be kind of anti logo. They are no logo people. Like it's not. They didn't even sell band shirts at those events.
I'd love to have some statistician come in and just start collecting other data points on them to find out. There must be other weird consistencies. Like, oh, that's weirdly related to this.
I think a love of patchouli might come up quickly.
Yes. we are in kind of patchouli-loving territory as well, but we are also in the territory of one Tom Lehrer, who...
Mm.
I guess divides his time between because he taught math at UC Santa Cruz.
All right. Oh, I thought he was from MIT.
I think he went to MIT, but I know that in the 70s he taught math and musical theater here at UC Santa Cruz.
He got around.
Funny. Because we think of him as sort of a Boston figure as well.
I actually have he was a very big presence on the local scene in Boston when I was a little kid, I have a vanity record made by him, like the record that he sold his shows. It's 10-inch vinyl.
You still have that somewhere?
Yeah, yeah. I it's in my kitchen.
Oh my god!
It's in my stack of 10-inch records that are, you know, I only have like 15 of them, but they're a different size, so they stick out.
I think I have his phone number. I have a number that I think is his, and every year or so I'll look at it and go, I just want to call him and just say thanks or hi or ask him if he wants to do the podcast.
Right.
And now I'm in Santa Cruz and I'm really tempted, but I'm too afraid.
Hmm. Oh, you can give him a ring, I'm sure.
His 80s. I don't want to be like, hi, I'm this really big man.
Right.
What? Who's this now?
I don't know. I talk like an old man now.
I think he always talks like an old man.
Yeah.
You hear those old recordings from even the 40s and he's like, all right, today we're going to learn about mathematics.
Right.
That sort of pan-Pacific. I actually made a list. I never do this. I always just sit down and talk to people, but I made a list for you.
Well, before
you
launch into the list, let me compliment you on your podcast. I've listened to your podcast for a little while, and I've always been impressed by your ability to kind of change your mode for whoever you... Like, when you're talking with more serious people, you actually get more serious.
Oh, wow.
And when you talk to, like... You know, people who are sort of easy breezy, you keep it easy breezy. And I'm really curious what it's going to be like when you try to interview us.
If this is indeed a Rorschach.
Because if you think we're some kind of clowns, buddy, you're in for a different kind of interview.
No. I'm just going to keep it light and fun.
Okay.
The year is 1981.
Right. So you don't respect us is what you're saying. Yeah, either way, you lose.
Well, first of all, I'm completely honored and flattered that you've even heard of my podcast. You guys are you're pioneers in a lot of respects, but... Certainly podcast pioneers. I mean, you guys, I think that They Might Be Giants podcast started in 2005, right?
We started doing it relatively early on. You know, it was kind of, like, I have to say, in many ways, you know, at the risk of running parallel to the Al Gore myth, I feel like culturally, we were really waiting for the internet to start as a vehicle for a lot of things that we'd like to do.
Right.
You know, so it's fun to have like kind of, you know, to have the world shift in like what feels like our direction.
Well, in other words, like things like Dial a Song.
Yes.
Were in some ways just this, you know, this idea waiting for something like the internet that would make
it really didn't work. Make that much sense then. Now it just seems like, oh yeah.
Well, but
right. There are those guys who do that thing. Yeah.
But Dial a Song was, in my opinion, the internet before the internet. Mm-hmm. Before there was, you know, a commercially viable.
I guess so. Yeah. Internet. Yeah. I mean, you know, we were really doing what we could, you know, all we could do. I mean, I think it's important to remember before you start thinking like we have some greater idea of like how to get somewhere in the world. Like we were very specifically not being courted by record labels, or I mean we had very little going on. So it was like it was very easy to just sit at home and put these songs on a phone machine, and it was something we could afford to do. We couldn't really, you know, when we started this band, sort of part of the thing of the format was, I guess everything is, the true answers are always kind of more complicated, like there's more than one level. Like we started working with tape and drum machines, which is a huge artistic decision to make. But it's also like if you're in New York City and you're broke and you're living in a one bedroom apartment, and unless your best friend is a drummer and like lives at his mom's house in the suburbs, yeah. You're gonna have a very difficult time having drums in your band. So like there was part of it that was just made it easier for us.
Also, keeping a band together is a huge pain in the ass, and having to unload drums and into.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, there was a point where we actually, over the first couple years of the band, we were doing a lot of like showcasey kind of places. That makes it sound like a bigger deal than it was. We're doing a lot of like truly crappy places, like that would later become like the kind of place that would be like in LA would be pay to play.
Right. I mean, that was the experience of a showcase for us is
it wasn't like
there's nobody there who's there to see us.
Right. You know? Okay.
Yeah. But it wasn't like
it's just like whoever happens right. to be.
It wasn't like we were playing the China Club. We were playing at these like East Village places.
In stand up, we call those bringer rooms. They're like, uh-huh. If you bring 10 people, right. you can go up.
Yeah. So everybody, you know, we all know that kind of pain. But the thing about like because of those gigs, we were living in Brooklyn. And those gigs were always in Manhattan. We figured out like if we can actually not do like the lady with the van, and could actually get everything in two, if we could just carry it in our hands, then the show would cost like $3 instead of, you know. So we got like a really good cassette recorder instead of the reel-to-reel thing, and I had my guitar and my little amp, and John had his accordion. And that was when John made the move to accordion. Originally, he was playing an electronic keyboard. Mm-hmm. So even the move to the accordion was kind of a way to kind of get through the world without it being, like, too complicated.
Did you... You went to Pratt?
I went to Pratt, yeah.
And what did you study at Pratt?
I studied fine arts. I ended up... Someone was just telling me this recently. They don't let you do this anymore. I transferred with a graphic design portfolio, like a commercial artist portfolio, mm-hmm. which I had done for work before I went to Pratt. So I had a really good looking portfolio. And then the day I got there, I immediately went into fine arts. So because I didn't want to do that. It's just something that I had done.
Yeah.
Evidently, they don't let you change. It's really hard to get into. I would never have gotten in as just a regular student. I only got in because I had professional experience before.
Okay.
So I kind of bluffed my way in and then did the switcheroo.
What did you study, other job?
I went to college, University of Massachusetts, for 1 year, and I did not declare a major during that time. And essentially, I just took a year off, which is still in effect.
Right. You're going to go back, though, right?
I don't know.
I feel like at this point, they should be like, here's a degree. You've done okay.
Well, the University of Massachusetts gave Bill Cosby an honorary doctorate degree in education. I think you should go for that.
I'm not sure what good it'll do. It'll do me or the school.
And then you could lord it over everyone in the credits of everything you do.
People like, start
Dr.
calling
Dr. Cosby, yeah, ED.
Right.
Dr.
John Linnell.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, he did. Listen, I'm a huge Cosby fan. I love Bill Cosby. I think what he has done for comedy was amazing. But every time I saw Dr. William Cosby in the thing, I was like, well, really?
Well, he's got a cultural thing.
That's true.
In those situations, he's speaking to, you know, like a political thing, and he is an army of one in many cases. But I don't know. Those are fun. You know what's funny is like those records. Like we grew up with Bill Cosby records.
Sure.
Like they were part of like, and you know, we listened to them like they were
as if they were music.
Beatles records.
Yeah.
You know, it's very strange now to think of like. I can't imagine listening to a comedy record for mastery.
Right.
Noah. You know, it's like how you don't really need to memorize the gaps in the Shaggy Dog tale.
I mean, listen, not to get all like old guy or anything, but
you're with the wrong crowd if you don't want to get old.
That's true. It's really true. For me, just because. I mean, everyone just takes everything for sort of like what you said about dial a song. Everyone sort of takes for granted. Now, of course, you do that. But comedy albums in particular were just these. It was an industry, like this really special thing. And now it's like people don't really buy comedy albums anymore.
Yeah, they're just souvenirs now, I guess. You know, and they don't really have any. I don't know if anybody's made like a culturally important comedy album. But I don't know. And you know, I think in a strange way. I mean, I don't want to speak for John, but when I think about what we're doing, I've often wanted to say, and there's never a right context to say this, but maybe this podcast is actually the exact right place to say it. It's like something like I don't know if you're ever familiar with the Firesign Theater.
Of course.
But you see, like the Firesign Theater are a very strange, especially in their psychedelic moment when they were making albums. Those are like not. You know, if comedy can exist without punchlines, that's what that is.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it bridges this thing where it's like it's a kind of performance art, but it doesn't. It's so free of pretension.
Right.
That it's just totally weird. You know, it's completely weird stuff.
That's interesting you say that. So do you feel like that in a way you're expressing some of that with what you got?
I would say to the extent that they weren't doing anything that, in other words. They weren't starting a new genre. They were just doing something completely individual. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, maybe that seemed like a good idea. It's not that we weren't...
We don't want to be the Firesign Theater.
Yeah, we're not being the Firesign Theater. We're just thinking, we don't have to say this is one thing or the other or any particular thing. And that, in a way, that was the very nucleus of this project was that we didn't define it to ourselves. And we didn't say what even whether it had to strictly be... Recorded music or live or whatever, it's what it is and it follows its own logic.
I guess just to finish, why I brought it up is because what's wonderful about them is that, especially in that golden 70s moment, is that it exists with no context at all. Like you can't say, I mean, I guess you could say it's like music for heads.
Right.
But as you know, but we were little kids. Like we didn't know anything about drugs or a psychedelic experience. We were just listening to these. Kind of free floating,
right? But it wasn't music. I mean, that's the thing. It was a kind of radio drama,
right,
or something, you know.
But it's just the fact that
comedy element and.
But the fact that it was like it was comedy without jokes and sort of this I don't know it had this poetics to it. It's crazy. It's just weird stuff.
There's so much. I mean, I wouldn't ever say like, oh, they might be giants. They're a comedy band. But as a young comedy fan. The second I was aware of you,
right.
I was instantly absorbed and like, oh my god, this is so different than anything. And like it just spoke.
Yeah,
my
I think that's the thing about it's like it was always irksome if people said we were a particular thing, like you know that we were comic or something, because we kind of felt like this great freedom in not defining what we were doing, and you know, it's in that sense it is really similar to as John was saying, like of that. That kind of thing, which was appealing. That's the great thing about the Firesign Theater was young kids tuning into the alternative, or what I guess they then called underground radio. Yeah, at the time would hear it and immediately lock on. You'd go, "This is I love this. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is." And there actually is a thing like that now, which I've kind of become more aware of through my son, which is just this world of kind of cultural UFOs on YouTube, you know, that are similarly undefined, they're not aspiring to anything. They're just individual nuggets of oddball, you know. Some of it is humorous, some of it is just, you know, trippy.
Yeah.
And it's in a way, it's a similar kind of thing.
On your way to being Rickrolled,
right?
You will experience many things.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of, I mean, it seems like there's a lot of absurd stuff, for lack of a better way of defining it. But that's, you know, it just exists in this unhinged world, right? You know.
Well, I mean, the world of comedy in general, it just seems like it's actually kind of exploding in this in this way now.
Well, it is. Right. I mean, there are definitely, you know, like 10 years ago, you know, comedy had a bit of a dip. Actually, all through the 90s, comedy had a bit of a dip. And it's definitely coming back now and strengthened by the internet. And, you know, I mean, Louis C.K. being able to sell so many of his comedy special downloads.
But does that make Louis C.K. the radio head of comedy? I mean, like, it's just like, it's like,
I didn't think
because,
about that.
You know, because it just means like, yeah, it's good for, you know, he can do that, but can anybody else?
No,
do that?
No. You really, I mean, yes, anyone can do it, but only someone who has a following that size already is really going to, and I actually,
right.
You know.
And he's at a very specific moment in his career. It's like, you know, He is very, I mean, obviously he's been working for a long time, but he's also enjoying a kind of public notoriety that is not going to last forever. I mean, he is the hot guy.
It's just one of the unfortunate things with...
Or, I mean, who knows? Maybe he'll get
no,
bigger
no,
and bigger.
But it is one of the unfortunate things with comedy is that, you know, it's... You sort of form this relationship with an audience, and it's almost of a sexual nature where they're really, really, really into it.
You see, it's not like that with music.
It's platonic.
Tell me more about this sex comedy thing.
I just think it's that, you know, like once they sort of, I mean, I guess going back to Tom Lehrer, is that he did everything sort of backwards to what a contemporary or like a modern comedian would do, which is as soon as he would build up and build up and build up and then to a live performance, and then he wouldn't do those songs anymore because he'd go, well, now everyone knows the jokes. Like, once I've recorded them and I've put them out,
right.
You can't get them again.
Right, right.
And so now so much more seems to be sort of in the reverse where you sort of do the same jokes over even though people know them and you build it out. And I guess... You know, with a comedian, people, once they kind of get your voice, they go, okay, I got it. I'll see that guy once or twice, but I don't really need to go back after that.
Right. I mean, one of the nice things about music is you have the secret weapon of, like, melody and that, you know, the hook part of it.
People like hearing stuff more than once.
People like hearing again. I mean, when we started in a very different place than... You know, most band. We were never like a garage band or a local band. Like, we actually started in these clubs in New York City that were pretty pretentious in their own way. And we started in performance art spaces by and large, and we were often kind of the most, you know, the thing with like the high. I mean, generosity of spirit was not necessarily running high in these places. There were a lot of things that were, you know, were very confrontational.
I am so glad that people have always been judgy. I'm glad that's not just a now thing.
We performed for many audiences where, you know, virtually every person in the audience was, you know, his arms were folded. And
oh my God, see those people still.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So it's so you kind of, a lot of the stuff that we did in the beginning, you know, was. Sort of trying to break that up, you know, kind of make people come, sort of, I guess we were confronting people in a way. We were sort of forcing them to deal with us. But
well, I felt like there was an amazingly warm, you know, vibe at those, you know, Dorinka and ABC when we.
Well, Dorinka was, that was a golden period.
What other acts were going up around the same time?
Well, we played on bills with, like, I mean, a lot of acts that you don't know. We did shows with Steve, when Steve Buscemi was in a performance art duo, right. We did shows with him. We did a lot of double bills with a performance group called Watchface, who were really fantastic. And I don't know if their stuff has ever been documented, but if YouTube ever had a purpose, it would be to show people what they were doing.
They were terrific.
They were really, really sharp. You know, we played on lots of double and triple bills. There's a place called ABC that had a big performance piece and then three smaller acts on every single night. So the sheer girth of stuff that was happening, we would play there every 3 weeks.
And it was this very hyperactive period in the East Village scene, like 84 to 87. And it was it was sort of that Keith Haring, Madonna.
Oh, right.
It was
very
day glow.
Of course.
You know, but those people were, you know, that world was the immediate local world. Like, it was not weird to be like, oh, I'm walking down the street and the Beastie Boys are walking down the street. Like, it was exactly that stuff, you know?
I would think you would be refreshing to a crowd of, like, really, like, when people go up and do, like, really serious performance pieces, and then you guys get up and you're...
Believe it or not, a lot of the performance was very lighthearted. You know, there was a funny thing.
Yeah.
It was not like you're in a gallery watching something and everyone had their hand on their chin. It was more like there was this kind of amused gaiety to the whole vibe. I mean, particularly Darinka and ABC, where we were playing, I felt like you'd see something and there was just like kind of a good vibe, and drinks were being served, you know, so it was
very cabaret.
Yeah, it had a very pleasant vibe. It wasn't like, this is too cool for me, or, you know, I'm too cool for this or something.
So what happened when you guys started playing?
Well, I was going to say,
like a regular kind of mainstream roots.
Well, I guess the thing is like, we had all this stuff in our act that was like, you know, almost running the risk of being like kind of prop comic-y.
Okay.
Like, we had these big papier-mâché hands that we did this very elaborate choreographed dance to one of our songs, this song called Number 3. And it was, you know, it was, I mean, that really loosened things. We were definitely, you could not take us too seriously after we did that part of the show. But what happened very quickly is that once the big challenge was going from being like a cabaret act where it seemed like breaking the ice was the gig, mm-hmm. to being like a legit touring musical act in the world of like alternative rock, which was had its own a whole other kind of self-seriousness going on. And, you know, I mean, that was, you know, drunken college nights for a lot of people, for absolutely. But it also was, you know, it was the beginning of, you know, indie cred.
Right.
And what was tricky about our show is that we realized that if we did any of these things that were prop-based, we would just become... Our show could quickly become like a Rocky Horror Picture.
Yeah. I think we when we first toured America, we turned it into a two guys songs with a tape recorder kind of an act.
And yeah, we actually threw out all the props it was a very conscious decision to just no longer have any of that stuff. And I, you know, truth of the matter is like we personally like that stuff, but we didn't want it to. We didn't want it to become a ritual, I guess. A friend of mine was talking about like the difference between like the first time Pete Townsend smashed the guitar and like the second time Pete Townsend smashed the guitar, and like it's really a world of difference, you know. Like the first time you experience it, it's like, oh man, that's mind blowing.
Right.
The second time, it's like, well, that's sort of something else.
Oh, I guess he knew he was going to do that. You know?
Yeah,
you can't really surprise people with the same thing twice.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's so interesting to see how. I think Colton is soundtracking.
Yes, Jonathan Colton is pounding away.
By the way, great job. I mean, his new album is. You guys did an amazing job.
Oh, thank you.
Was that John?
Yeah, yeah.
John,
I did it in my copious free time.
It's so funny. It's so funny to see Colton with a band. I mean, I'm so used to doing shows with him. It's just like, oh, John and then with a guitar,
right.
Paul and Storm in the back.
Right, right.
But, and, you know, like, single musician guitar music doesn't always blow up to this. And you did an amazing job turning this into a band.
Well, I just, you know, tried to sort of follow wherever he wanted to take it.
Yeah.
Yes?
Hold on a sec. We're in the middle of a thin jig here.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
We've got a lot of covers for you, Anna.
Great.
You must be signing 2,000 covers.
Yeah, I think so.
So
these are done. These are not done.
Okay.
These are done.
I'll take these.
How's it
this is what I need for.
Okay.
How's it that you're able to sign all these and then go play an accordion and not have to rub liquid painkiller on your hand?
Yeah, no, it's well, if you look at my sloppy signature, you can see I'm not hurting myself too much here.
about John Feinberg.
Any hit, sorry about that.
There's about half of those LPs are done, the ones that are out of the box.
But well, I mean,
I can finish them up.
Whatever. Because I have what I need for tonight, at least.
Very good.
You have time.
I saw you guys at Royce Hall a few years ago.
Yep.
And that was, I mean, I've seen you, I think, 4 or 5 times. And the Royce Hall show was amazing. And it was the first time that I had ever heard you define what some of your music is as fact-based songs.
Oh, uh-huh. And wait, was it a kids show?
No, it was... No. It was... You did Lincoln.
Oh, okay.
Right. I think that expression... Well, first of all, it was either ironic or pointing out the glaring fact that our supposedly fact-based material is riddled with factual errors, you know? So yeah. I mean, I think, you know, again, just to come back, like, I know you have a larger point to make about that, but we're really not a fact-based band.
But some of them just...
We're a fiction-based band.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. because I just thought when I was...
That was a character saying
that. Was right.
But the reason that it resonated with me is because I have a musical comedy duo, not unlike the Paul and Storm, and the first handful of songs we were writing were just about science, like in the 90s. Like, we wrote a song about the carbon cycle, we wrote a song about the numerical value of pi, and I didn't really know what it was that we were doing, but when you said fact-based songs, I was like, oh my god,
well, you know, we early on were identified because we did basically 2 biographical songs. I think that because that was such an unusual thing, that immediately people hooked on to this thing. Oh, these guys write songs that are biographical. They write biographies. You know, we had a song about James K. Polk and a song about James Ensor, and that was enough. And people thought,
even Istanbul, which is a really it's a cover, or like a song like Why Does the Sunshine, which is also a science song from our childhood.
I have some...
Oh, you have science songs?
Someone posted all of those High Zaret songs.
Right, right.
And they had... And I went to it before I came here. I was like, I wonder if that's still up. He had just had them on LPs and just digitized them.
Right. Yeah, no, I know.
And I went there to get them, and it was like, this is just should give you an idea of how long ago old it was. This GeoCities site is no longer available.
Yeah, it was on some... Well, I was actually trying to recover a version of the Shooting Star song when we did a cover of that years back. And I found that site, and it really was like, it's like looking at some really embryonic code.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
It's like the user group loves this.
Are these an Og Vorbis?
What are they?
But it was just like energy and motion songs, and then an album of science songs, an album of weather songs.
They made like 4 of them.
Yeah. Like Dottie Evans.
There were different artists. Moraine Miranda did the weather songs.
Yeah, I think those projects were like, you know, they really fired up the super strong coffee and just like charged forward into the recording studio. I mean, the strange thing about that Why Does the Sunshine song is that the actual text is from an encyclopedia and the melody is from an Irish folk song. So it's really just this kind of confabulation of an original song, even though to us, like, we think of it as like this sort of urtext of They Might Be Giants' Nest. It's it's almost kind of phoned in a certain way.
At the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got a couple session musicians.
Right. Yeah, it's just like, guys, it's 3:00. We've only done 7 of these.
And High Zaret, the same guy who wrote Why Does the Sunshine, also wrote Unchained Melody, which I think is amazing.
Yeah, he had a bunch of hits. He had some other... He had one other really big hit that everybody knows.
It's very Google-worthy.
Yes.
I know in the movie Ghost, the famous pottery scene was between Why Does the Sunshine and Unchained Melody. And they were like, it just doesn't play as well with Why Does the Sunshine. You guys have done a ton of... You guys have done a ton of songs for music and television. And, and is that sort of a different mode that you guys go into?
Sometimes we are hired to be They Might Be Giants, and obviously that's like the most groovy and gratifying gig, is if they get us to do our thing. There's really every different flavor of doing that kind of commercial work, you know. Sometimes we are really in the dungeon of make it sound like this
right. And that you don't actually like.
Yeah.
You
know. We've done lots of faceless soundalikes, you know. And some of them are actually, you know, it can be fun to do, you know, if you get some. For a long time we did music for Play-Doh, and we did music for Diet Dr. Pepper.
Uh-huh.
And,
oh, really? I didn't know that.
And both of those jobs were, I mean, they never had our name on it. Like, and often,
right.
You know, but, you know, some of this stuff just played like crazy. Yes. I mean, it was great. It was great stuff. It was a great gig. Definitely kept us from being broke.
Right. Well, but also something like, you know, Malcolm in the Middle, where they go,
well, that's very, that
we
want to
put your music all over the show because you sort of embody this kind of, like, the music really, I mean, I can't think of who else would have been suited for that show.
Yeah, that they were very gung-ho when we started with them about sort of incorporating our sound into the thing. And we spent a couple of years doing incidental music for them, so that was a big assignment. And we did all the music for The Daily Show as well. And I don't think a lot of people realize that, like, the orchestral cues are stuff that we put together.
Yes. Did I notice you guys covering Paranoid with the Avatars?
Yes, yes. Well, we're always looking for a good song for the Avatars to cover, and we did it. We actually did a. We spent a little. We worked pretty hard on a cover of Midnight Train to Georgia, with the Meg Ryan puppet doing the lead vocal, and I liked it, but I think it sort of felt like it was a little. I don't know. Yeah, I think the Paranoid is actually has a nice, has a better vibe to it.
Well, not only does it, do we lock this? Are you locked out?
Sorry.
Yeah, it's a weird thing to figure out. You know, I mean, you have to kind of do it in order to know what's a good, you know, what's a good way to do it. It's very weird to do a puppet show in the middle of our show because it's not, it's so ill-defined. It's like, it's so unclear what the hell it is or what it's supposed to be, you know.
But I think that's
so
what...
So we're still casting around in a way to find, you know...
Yeah, but I think
find
what...
Find out where it
just
lives.
From a fan's point of view, I mean, I feel like I understand... What, you know, at least I feel like I understand what you guys are about. So when you do stuff like that, I just go, yes, this is exactly
I think the idea of it on paper is like, yes, yes, puppet show, fantastic. I'll go see any band that does that. But what you actually do with it is sort of, it's so unclear. Like the trails are not marked in the forest, you know. Like,
well, I mean, I guess, you know, one thing about a lot of the raps with the puppets is that we really enjoy. Well, it's like a lot of things that we in what we do, which is that I sort of feel like we're doing it for ourselves because it really actually lets us get outside of ourselves. And the puppets end up spending a lot of time, like, we sort of experiment with different ways that the puppets can, like, insult or accuse me and John of, like, very like, they're very angry
characters.
They're very angry characters, and it's really delightful for us to not just be like. I guess, you know, the thing about being a performer and, you know, you might be very animated by the material and the ideas inside, like, the work that you're presenting, but you might not really want it to be so much about, like, what a great guy you are, or, like, you know what I mean? Like
right.
in like, a world right. of people, like, you know, I could pick out a million different mainstream performers who are really, like, it's about saying, like, the message is, isn't it great being with me? You know,
right, that, like me, or also that you aspire to be this
right.
kind of person.
It can be like a hero worship thing, or it can be like a, there's a million shades of it, but it's all about, like, you know, I'm your teddy bear, I'm your, you know, I'm your funny brother, or I'm your, like,
yes.
I'm somebody that you can identify in some way that feels comfortable and like just. Being, you know, sharing this celebratory thing is like this comfortable thing, and the thing that's great.
The Bieber sector.
Yeah, exactly. So the great thing about having like a puppet show like that we've
created is it really smashes that in this, you know, it's taking this form that's really, by its nature, just incredibly cozy. You know, it's a puppet show. So how mean-spirited can a puppet show be?
Well, not only that, but I would imagine that as performers, it just helps you keep your show fresh. This Jonathan Coulton is loud. Can you believe this young?
Oh no, we only go after ourselves. We leave everybody else out. You know.
I'm saying Coulton is. This Jonathan Coulton right now is loud.
Oh, wait, he is loud. Oh, I think you're being the puppet.
No.
Hypothetically insulting.
You were doing a very good puppet. For
yeah,
us.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly how the puppets talk.
I broke
There's
the bit
no
for
difference.
A second to right. to, okay. just, to reference right. Jonathan Cole. But
got it.
But I think it, just as a performer, it just sort of opens you up to keep your material fresh and play around with the show.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, you know, talking about this, it makes me realize there is a tradition, and it's a weird one, of people, not with puppets, but with you know, ventriloquist dummies, to be that, you know, the usually the puppeteer is a sort of like, hi, how's it going? And then the dummy is this like weird id creature that's coming from the guy. You know, it's like his worst impulses are being expressed.
Yeah, I think that's it's exactly the same. It's basically
that, yeah.
it's, you know, we might as well have them on our laps.
Did I read somewhere online correctly that there might be an Avatars of They album?
We started working on some of the tracks for them. You know, part of it is that there's a sort of a general thirst for just doing different kinds of projects.
Right.
And it's just a way to do different stuff. I mean, one thing that's nice about doing Avatar stuff is that it's by definition two voices.
Yeah.
So we can kind of write thinking like what's good for writing for two voices.
Well, and what's also interesting about that is that, you know, just sometimes when you first start out, I think when you first start out writing, it's hard, particularly in comedy. Like, well, I don't really know who I am and what I want. But if I were to picture a single dimensional character.
Oh, yeah.
Outside myself.
Oh,
well, I know how to write from that point of view, and it just makes it a little bit easier and more fun.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, that's the thing that's, you know, I've had lots of conversations with Jonathan Coulton about this idea, which is the idea of writing a song about yourself seems very strange. But writing a song from like sort of an unreliable character point of view is very, very easy. But what's weird is when you start getting into this John Updike thing where like the unreliable character bears a striking resemblance to you exactly, you know, or even more like a Philip Roth.
Well, that's a popular thing in fiction.
Yeah.
That idea, and that comes up in all sorts of
things. I don't understand rock music that writes songs. I've never understood how you write a song about rock music. Like, that's such a weird... So many rock bands are like, this is rock music, you're listening... Like, from the 70s.
Oh,
like,
right.
They were basically just singing about the thing that they are doing to the audience.
That seems completely harmonious in a way.
I guess.
But I don't know, like, you know, I was watching an interview with the guy... I don't even know the guy's name. The guy who replaced Bon Scott in AC/DC.
Right.
And he was talking about, you know, he had like the weirdest gig in the world. Like, he had to replace this guy that everybody liked who just happened to die.
Right.
You know, so it's just like, good luck with that.
Sorry, I'm not your dead friend.
It's like, everybody's cool with that, though, right?
I mean, you know, this is what he would have wanted.
Yeah, right. Yeah, maybe not.
I don't know. We'll never know.
Yeah. But you better not fuck that up. But you know, he wrote the words to the "You Shook Me All Night Long." I guess that's essentially like was one of the earliest things he ever did for that band.
Right.
And it was like a screed, like it had a gajillion words to it. And I mean, it's a really clever song, and it's exactly. I mean, when you think about AC/DC, like who are AC/DC as a band? Like that is them. In I mean, I guess you could, you know, there are certainly Bon Scott songs that would be there, but like it has all the moving parts of exactly what AC/DC is about, and it is just a like we're gonna rock song. But I mean, it's kind of a testament to how awesome AC/DC is because the texture of it. It's incredibly rich, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like it just goes and goes and goes. I mean, because they've got an awful lot of rocking to do.
They still have a bit of rocking.
Oh yes, they're made of the rock.
And the schoolboy outfit just gets funnier and funnier, like each year.
Oh yeah, yeah. I saw them
they
when
get
he was
more beautiful.
I think he was 17 when I first saw them, and it wasn't. It actually wasn't that. He was just wearing his same schoolboy outfit that he wore in two years earlier or whatever.
Yeah, he's tiny.
Yeah.
It was actually his schoolboy outfit.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Like, well, I still fit in this. I might as
yeah,
well
yeah,
just
keep. No, I think keep, that's... Yeah. He was crazy young when they started.
Do you feel pressure when people go see a They Might Be Giants show? I think they always expect stuff, you know, like a lot of different stuff and a lot of stuff coming at them. Do you feel pressure to have to keep, like, raising the stakes
on shows?
I
think the pressure comes from us, you know, that we sort of feel like... You know, it doesn't get any easier to make up songs, and we're our worst, you know, our meanest critics, I think. I don't think we're not very clued into what the audience, I mean, I think that's maybe an advantage that we have, is like we don't actually quite know what people are thinking, you know, but we certainly know what we think, you know, and we are, John and I are both pretty goddamn hard on ourselves.
Yeah. I think it's somewhere in the mid-90s, which might have been a period where, like, people who really liked the most manic stuff that we did, I think there was a point where we realized that we weren't boring people. And I think we were before... There was a point where we probably were annoying a lot of people, but we were worried about boring people. Right. Very, very... In a very direct way. Like, we had a very short attention span. Not because... You know, just because... We're just nervous guys,
right?
I think, you know, and we were nervous guys. We were drinking a lot of coffee. We were slightly scared by being on stage in a pretty essential way, and we just didn't want to take up too much time.
You still felt that into the 90s, really?
We know how to do what we're doing, and we know, I think we have a really good sense of, like, you know, personal true north. Mm-hmm. But we don't make many assumptions about what, you know, we're not deeply in love with ourselves. I think, like, we are as insecure as most people are.
I think it was, you know, your explosion in the 80s was very empowering for people like myself, just like young nerdy kids, comedy fans looking for something different, looking for something interesting, and going, oh my god, two really smart guys can make something that is different than everything else.
I think if we came along, you know, I think the world is a much friendlier place to people like us. Like, just even working within the record label thing, it was very hard for us to feel like there was a natural place for us to land there, because there wasn't a lot of precedent. And I'm not trying to make, like, some kind of humble brag. I'm actually trying it was kind of a sucky time. I mean, part of it was, like, for alternative rock in general, it was a sucky, you know, even if you were Husker Du and you were just, like, awesome in every rock way, or the Replacements, or, you know, take all those bands of that generation, there was a whole world of rock bands that really did not want to give up, of established bands that didn't want to give up their market share, you know.
Right.
And it's like they were working, you know. Rod Stewart was on the road. He had, like, top 40 hits, and, like, all those, you know, the guys who were editors at Rolling Stone, like, they knew him. Like, everybody's getting along, like, everything's cool. Like, nobody was particularly happy to see you know, a bunch of, you know, alternative rock band, whatever it was, whatever version of it was.
Right. I think the other thing is, like, we probably felt, I mean, just the way that people were responding to it, which was, oh, here's this really interesting, quirky, I think that, you know, we got some feedback at the time, which was like, we are quirky and oddball and, you know, and obviously, like, sort of, as John was saying, like, we're kind of, like, hyperactive and, you know, I mean, it's less true now than it was then, but our sense of what we were, yes, that's implicit what I'm saying. But our sense of what we were doing was actually not that we sort of felt like, you know, I think there was a perception by a lot of people that we were this successful kind of stink bomb or something, like, you know, that we were doing something just in opposition to other stuff. And as far as we were concerned, we were, like, not quite succeeding at being something more
ambitious.
Ambitious, yes.
Well, it sort of gets back to that Firestone Theater thing of, like, being self-defined. Like, the rock world was this culturally dominant thing. It wasn't... You know, we live in this fantastic world now where there's so many different things going on, and everybody kind of celebrates this tremendous cultural diversity, and it's like, whoa, you're into like snowboarding and listening to ukulele music at the same time? Like, that's what I do, you know?
I can find those other thousand people.
Exactly, exactly. So there's the world of sort of niche-y things is much more celebrated now. You know, it took me a really long time to even understand like the word geek the way it's used now.
Sure.
Because like, to me, like, geek is just like the word that was being muttered by the guy like punching me in the face.
Yeah, yeah.
When I was being bullied in junior high school, you know, it was not like there was no like
it wasn't like a celebratory thing.
Right. No, I grew up in the 80s, and it was the same thing then. And certainly there's a lot of, you know, talk between, you know, what's a nerd, what's a geek. You know, I know the show's called The Nerdist, but also nerd is also a completely, you know, overused term now. But and I do say, like, I always tell people, like, it was really not a cool thing in the 80s. Like, it was a word that sort of kept you in your place.
Right. What's interesting is that we've actually now reached a point where you have to say that, you know. That
right.
It's not, I feel like it wasn't so long ago that there was this kind of like, yeah, nerd, have you heard? Nerd is cool.
Yeah.
And now it's just like the pure pejorative seems to be completely buried, you know, like,
yeah.
Like nerd was not something anyone aspired to be.
No, it was pretty bad.
Like, it would be like wanting to be an asshole or something, or like a loser.
But I guess the larger point I was trying to get to is that the idea of trying to be kind of beyond category was something that that was actually what we were ambitious about, and that was very tangible to us, that like we could really float between styles and genres, and it's not just a pastiche, it's actually original music with original ideas. And you might feel like, oh, this kind of thing is familiar, but still it's being set up in a way that's sort of jarring and just original, you know, just trying to do something singular.
Yeah, yeah, and good. I mean, that was, you know, even more than that, it was something that someone would hear and hear some particular subtlety that we'd put in there that was the kernel of truth and brilliance.
Oh, no, that's an interesting point.
But most people, when they hear a band like us, they'll really latch onto the pastiche part of it, mm-hmm. and right. think, oh, you're involved in musical parody. Oh, I know what that is. Or just like it has comedy in it. So like that's like this nitroglycerin that blows up all artistic validation. It's just like, oh, how could it be more than just a linear thing that makes you go, ha.
I never thought of it as comedy. I always thought of it as just a whole separate universe.
But you liked it. But like, you know, I think the world disagreed.
I can't imagine. Well, that I think that's just businesses trying to market stuff, and that's
right.
On
behalf of the band, we want to apologize to anyone who's ever had to market us.
You can't explain to a marketer like, wow, what am I supposed to put on my spreadsheet? They're like, well, it's unique and it's our voices and this is who we are.
Right.
I don't know.
Well,
I gotta
talk. It's a problem that it's a problem for us because we were very involved in the marketing of ourselves, and it was always a big question, like, how do you, you know, we had long discussions early on about whether we should be using our own faces, you know, our image, you know, or how do you, there's certain bands you admire that don't ever use their own image at all.
That's like Slipknot.
You know.
The residents,
you know.
But that was actually something that, you know, the idea of not having our faces was something that we really seriously considered. But then we realized how beautiful we were, and we just couldn't.
Well, I feel like it's important for people to be able to relate to. I mean, maybe that's just a now thing.
I like doing that with. There's certain other bands. I feel like it is important. There's like maybe if there's like seven guys in the band that. And this is kind of a memory that
Chicago needed
to,
a Peter Cetera. That's all.
You have the experience of sitting, listening to the music while holding the album cover and looking at each guy and going, oh yeah, that's the slightly shorter version of the guy who looks like the other guy.
Yeah.
He's got, you know, bad teeth.
When I had that old Doobie Brothers album where it's just all of them, you know, because there were 100 Doobie Brothers.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
But I think there's a big distance between like fandom or even like, you know, what you aspire to be. Like, I think one thing we found out about, you know, we worked for a lot of years before we even made our first album. And we started we did just a handful of shows in 82, but really started in 83. And we didn't really finish a first album until the end of 87. So there was many years of, like, doing lots of live shows and figuring out. I think we've actually there were a lot of ideas that we were interested in that we realized we weren't that good at, too. And that was pretty valuable. Like, we were not catapulted into success very early on. So we sort of flourish in obscurity. Just
well, what was the sort of goal at that point when you take, you know, 5 or 6 years to make your first album? Like, what are you thinking? This
well,
is
we arrived
become?
In New York at the height of this very what is now this sort of lost to the time, like the no wave period of New York punk rock, mm-hmm. which was probably like the least successful component of like the new wave explosion, but like that they were very big. There was a moment where they were very considered very cool bands, like the James White and the Blacks and the Contortions and DNA and Lydia Lunch, and they were very super noisy, like the noise, like think of right. like in, you know, industrial music without a beat, kind of.
Okay.
Like very, very noisy, and basically people hated this stuff, like they hated it. But we were the exact age, you know, we were 21, 22, coming from like college towns into New York as young people, and it was that was the stuff, you know, that was what was going on. And when we started doing stuff, like other bands, other guys we knew who were in bands, you know, they did, you know, they were like, we had a friend who was like in an industrial band, and that was like sort of like a screamy, there was a lot of screamy stuff,
right? A lot of noise happening. Because then also this sort of notion, the New York component was that it had a kind of an art quality, you know, like,
oh yeah,
like the, you know, like yeah, the Ardo Lindsay sort of, you know, combination of music, noise, and some kind of artistic patina that was even a little bit hard to work out, like what
but are you thinking at this point, like, were you thinking like, we're gonna be able to pull all this together and make a living out of this somehow?
I think we're just figuring out, like, is there a way we could...
Yeah, we never thought this is a way to make money. I think that we were determined really to get at something that was you know, that we were fully aware.
You sound like sociopaths. Like,
no,
we were hell-bent on not making.
No, that's not what I was gonna say.
No, sorry.
I was gonna say we were very focused on this thing that was divorced from making money, and we had jobs, you know, we had other jobs, so we had this idea like, this is a thing that we can do that, you know, hopefully can sustain itself, and we can think of cheap ways to, you know, it was like a lot of it was about economy, you know, like we made those flexi discs,
yeah,
they cost like $1 a piece, you know, which was crazy, or less than that,
like they were like 20 cents a piece.
Yeah, they were super cheap, and you know, we just did a lot of legwork on our own, even up to the point where we were kind of thinking about ways to market, like once we'd made a record and we became aware of college radio and this notion of an audience outside of New York, we think, well, this is something, you know, we could sell it, and it turns out there's something called college radio that allows us to, you know, that we were on the college radio charts. That's how we found out about it. So we you know, we made a video, and it was just made for the cost of well, we didn't pay for the film.
Was that for what? Was this for Don't Let Start?
We paid for the first thing we did. We worked with this great guy who I really should reach out, figure out where he's living, and talk to him. This guy Adam Bernstein, who ended up he was the director on the very first 30 Rock. He also did the Love Shack video. He also did I Like Big Butts, he did that video.
Sir Mix a Lot.
He was working at Nickelodeon, just like, you know, probably he was younger than us, so he was probably, you know, in his early 20s, but he was very ambitious, working at this at Nickelodeon. Nickelodeon was a tiny affair, and he just had ambitions to become a rock music director, and you know, rock videos had only been going for like 2 years, but it was already quite established, like that it would be like all the things that were stinky about rock videos were already like firmly in place.
Oh, those early rock videos were so, I mean, even when you guys were playing Paranoid, I was like, I wonder if there's a music video for Paranoid, and I looked it up, and it's just Black Sabbath from 1970 standing in a space where they've keyed in weird dot,
oh,
like,
yeah,
mannequin,
yeah. No,
head images,
that.
But they're not even, they're so not dynamic in any way. Right. He's just standing there, and it's like, oh, they just shot these guys playing in a rehearsal space. Yeah. That those were music videos before.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, we basically just, What's interesting about the rock video thing, and I realized that, you know, we just did this video for When Will You Die, that the art director for the album did this time-lapse video of the creation of this monster hearse car that we have on the cover of the album. He basically built this 14-foot paper version of it and just documented the whole thing. And it has an arc to it in the way that viral videos do. Mm-hmm. And it very much is in that vocabulary of viral videos. And what's funny about it is it's a scenario. Like, it has a beginning and it has an end. And when we were coming up in the rock music thing, like, the only videos that had scenarios were the really bad ones. And it's just a funny thing to just generationally have lived so long to see. And I think part of it is that, you know, people go to film school now. People, like, know what a storyboard is. You know, I remember presenting, like, a storyboard to, I was doing a directing job, and I had a bunch of storyboards for a rock video of just, like, things that I wanted to do. And the cameraman was like, can't we just shoot? Like, why don't we just, can't have fun? You know, like, it's like the idea of doing a rock video was, like, that it was just kind of, the better ones were the ones that were kind of breezy.
Well, you could always tell, I mean, in as unique as the music was, you could always tell when they might be Giants video. You always knew there was going to be some special thing about it. And it wasn't even, they were just simple, just like shooting under the grating of Anna right. Ang or well, that, was that like was, all that stuff.
Adam Bernstein had a very, very good sense of cinematography and a very good sense of where to put the camera. And we had a good sense of sort of art direction and had a sort of restricted palette idea, you know. And in some ways, the sum total, and I think, ends up feeling a lot more like A Hard Day's Night than we ever expected it to be, because a lot of it was in black and white, but also a lot of it was, you know, we were trying to avoid lip syncing, mm-hmm. and the only other thing that's like that is Hard Day's Night. You know, there are all these sequences in Hard Day's Night where the Beatles are not lip syncing, because they were doing it on the cheap and really fast. And to lip sync in a non-studio, you know, if they were going to shoot outside, then they don't need lights.
Right.
But if you shoot outside, how are you going to sync sound? It's like, we'll just dance around. So, like, you know, that's, we found ourselves, you know, strangely in the, you know, same situation. I think the spirit of that is actually really winning, but it's kind of, I don't think there are any other parallels. I don't think anybody, you know, you never see Rod Stewart running around in a field.
not singing his lyrics.
Yes, not singing his lyrics.
I think, I can't, of any other band, I can imagine that you guys have the most misinterpreted lyrics. I would imagine people are constantly like, oh yeah, that one song is about this. You're like, really? That's not really what we intended at all. But there do seem to be a lot of dense layers in what you guys are writing.
Well, you know, I guess, you know, this is something that we've said, but it bears repeating, is there's a lot of lyrics which are just what they are, and they're you know, they might seem oblique, but it's really what you hear is what you get, you know, in many cases, and there isn't some code or secret message, you know. It's very entertaining to hear people's impressions of songs, and it's like, it's really about trilateral commission.
Right. Yeah. You know. I mean, a lot of the more far flung ones really have this kind of, like, you know, Animal Farm.
Right,
quality,
it's like
to them.
Some simple allegory, like, this thing represents this, you know.
This song's really about the Bay of Pigs.
Well, yeah, I don't think we've ever written a song where one thing represents some other specific thing that isn't mentioned in the song.
But I think that's great.
We should probably figure out how to do that.
I mean, you know what was fun? As the band who made those songs, you could create, it's just part and parcel of the mythos of They Might Be Giants. Like,
but see, we're not in on the mythos. That's the thing. Like, as you know, in a way,
is that weird?
Like, this is the curse of you know, actually doing the thing. Is like, we know exactly what this stuff is.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes it can be, you know, you can realize, like, that was all we could do. You know, we could have done a better job. It could have been a more complete idea.
So you have this Join Us is the last album, which is actually an album I'm holding in my hand.
Yes,
it's actually a vinyl.
It's a gatefold
record.
Album. Yeah. Well, these are very popular. The gatefold. I mean, they're sort of souvenirs in a way for people who come to shows, but they are beloved. And
I think they're. I mean,
it's cool.
First of all, turntables are surprisingly expensive. If you see a turntable in a store, you see them online, they are hundreds of dollars.
Yeah.
And you'd think, oh, yeah, $20 for an old...
Oh, you can still, but you can buy a crappy, you know...
I would recommend Crowley. Check out the Crowley product, the pride of China.
You can get very cheap turntables. I mean, I love smelling new records.
This is what I think, you know, people don't get this experience anymore of actually smelling like a new vinyl record. And it's something I always loved to do as a kid.
It's one of the only parts of the music business that's not... hemorrhaging, you know, that's not throwing up through its eyes.
Right. Like an episode of House.
It's not lupus. It's just the music industry.
My wife bought a thing that costs $50. That's a turntable with a USB cable sticking out. That's all it is. But it's
also you can burn.
Yeah, that's what it's
for. I always wanted the one that was the little van, and you'd put it on the record, and then the thing would drive around and play the.
What?
You never saw those?
No.
I feel like that was a 70s or 80s phenomenon.
Get out of here.
You'd get like a little vehicle, and it had a needle on it, and you set it on the record, and it would just drive around and circle. No, the record stays still.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah. I mean, you have to put it on. Wow. So you have to put it on a, you know, a little spindle, but then it just, the car just drives around, and there's a speaker on it, just plays
that
the.
I think if you could make a Bluetooth version of that, now we're in business.
I feel like the technology is
it's a simple
trip to the Radio Shack.
Right. So it's a little car that runs around in a circle, guided by the groove.
It's guided by the groove, yeah. And the sound quality is not great. It wasn't ever great. Fuck. But
with the right Bluetooth. That'd be crazy, badass.
That could be amazing.
So you're saying $100? This thing really existed.
This has existed. Yes, I remember it as being sort of a novelty item for people.
That is insane.
Yeah, I'm sure the new old stock eBay purchase is a buy it now for $1,200.
How would that even work? I feel like the groove wouldn't be enough to hold it in place.
I don't know. How did any of this... I mean, you know, those flexi-disc things were so weird.
I don't think it was amazing. But I also remember, was the flexi-disc like that was just like the
flexi-disc was made out of like a very thin piece of plastic.
They sounded crappy, and they were stuck into Life magazine.
I remember those.
To the moon.
I had a Bloom. Did you ever read Bloom County? Did you ever read the Bloom County? It's an old comic.
Oh, I know what it is. Yeah.
In one of the Bloom County books, the Bill the Cat had a band called Billy and the Boingers, and they put a little flexi-disc Billy and the Boingers thing that you would tear out of the book. Play it, and it just... It sounded weird.
Yeah, sounds good once, basically.
This has been our hour, and I don't want to keep you
because
you guys have a show.
We do, and we're
so under rehearsed.
We're so unprepared for this.
Do you feel that way still?
Well, we do.
We don't just feel that way. We are radically under rehearsed.
We're not. This is not.
But is that like that's just what you know?
We're doing two specialty shows tomorrow, so it's basically like we're doing a kids show. We haven't done a kids show in a year and a half, and we certainly have not been like rehearsing our kids material during that year and a half. So there's going to be, you know, 2,500 people staring at us, staring at our hands tomorrow. Yeah. And then tomorrow night we're playing a Lincoln show at Royce Hall. So that entails all this other.
Now I went to UCLA, so it was very special for me to see you there.
We have a regular gig that we know how to play. We just happen to be starting off this leg with the mistake of doing too much.
How many shows on the tour?
Oh, I don't know, like 25 or something like that.
That's not too terrible.
It's not bad at all, no.
And I saw a bunch of sold outs on there, which is different.
Everything's selling out, which is really exciting. You know, we've been on the road from the very beginning of the recession till now. And when it first started, it was like we were going to all these venues, and you know there were certain promoters, especially in the Midwest, who were like, "We are getting killed." And we'd get there and like we'd have a really good show. And it's like, you know, God bless you guys. and after like a year of shows, we felt like, oh well, we dodged that bullet. And then coming back out like a year ago, it seemed like, oh, maybe things actually are getting sort of like, you know, the people are settling into this I'm not going out anymore, I'm too broke thing. And things felt a little soft. But all of a sudden with this tour, it's like we're actually, you know, we're doing crazy business. It's like we're playing all these theaters. Like we're very used to kind of bobbing in and out between theaters and cities and clubs in towns, smaller cities. And it's actually a little bit strange because they're really different kinds of shows. Like to do a big theatrical show is it really draws on, you know, you need to give people a different experience. So, like, to be ping pong between clubs and theaters is just is a bigger challenge. Like, by the end right. of this thing, we'll have done like 20 theaters in a row, and I'm sure it'll just seem like, you know, just be like an off-Broadway show by the end.
At the end of those 25 shows, do you ever, oh, you guys, there should be like a Traveling They Might Be Giants themed musical show that...
Oh, like Giants on Ice?
Just something.
Like,
yeah. Oh, Giants on Ice would be amazing.
Well, you know, it would be interesting to just like, you know, farm it out to some young kids.
Yeah. And just let them do what Sound they do.
Like, you know, I mean, we, like, I feel like in seriousness, we talk to Disney because they have a... They have an entire department that's, you know, whatever thing they're promoting on Ice. And I was like, well, you know, we could do that. We had these sort of...
I think we'd have to be a lot bigger to do
that. We had these puppets that were perfect for upsizing up to human, you know, full human size.
I gotta tell you, I think Meet the Elements or any of that, I think any of that would be amazing on Ice. I think parents would... buy the shit out of those tickets for their kids. I mean, like, I mean,
well, that's the message we have for the parents. You're going to want to buy the shit
out of this for your kids. No, but honestly, like, just the idea that, you know,
I don't think we've sworn in the entire hour. Until,
you did. You dropped the F-bomb earlier.
Oh, I did?
And I made a mental note of it because I was like, that's awesome. Damn. Good. So I'm not the only filthy person here. But just, you know, I think it's such a challenge for people to be able to listen to music with their kids and not want to. I don't have any kids, but I'm guessing. And not want to tear their own eyes out. You know what? Want to tear their own fucking eyes out. Right? Huh? Yeah, right? Yeah,
there,
I just kind of filled it up a little bit. High five.
Episode. Yeah, no, it was our lucky break that the gaping vacuum, cultural vacuum of kids' stuff was there just for to be filled.
Like my friend Divya Srinivasan did something.
Oh, you know Divya?
Yes.
She's
great.
Wow.
I've worked with her before.
Yeah, she's great. She's done some great stuff for us. You know, like I love the thing she did with Damn Good Times. It was like fantastic.
Yeah.
How's she doing?
I think I haven't talked to her for a little while, but I talked to her a handful of months ago and she seemed to be doing really well.
I mean, she, you know, it's funny, she moved to Austin like in the middle of some projects we were doing together, and it seemed like I couldn't tell if that was good or bad.
I think it's good. Austin's a really good. It's just got a nice, like, little arty.
I think of Boston as being awesome.
She seemed. I mean, I bet she has this cool little house. Like, I don't know how many you know towns there are where you could have like a cool little house and a safe area. And,
sure. It's like Boys in the Hood, except really, really laid back.
Yeah, really laid back. Yeah, boys like in the condos.
Well, just like the little house thing is so funny in Boys in the Hood because like if you're from the East Coast, when you see all those little houses, like. How bad can it be? You've got a driveway.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the suburbs, you know. But, I mean, I recognize that there are parts of L.A. that people have driveways and freestanding houses, and they're very dangerous places to
live. Yeah, I mean, it's
just on the surface.
Just because, you know, those areas built out in the, you know, like you see these houses that you would go, oh, in the 40s, this was probably the snazzy part of town.
Right.
And then it just sort of migrated out. But, yeah, so just for people listening, Divya's website is pupae.net. PUPAE, and you can see a bunch of your videos
there as well. We've done millions of things with her.
But also, theymightbegiants.com is another place should go.
Sure, of course.
And at TMBG on Twitter.
Yeah, it's at TMBG on Twitter, and I'm on Twitter all the time.
Doing excellent. Stuff,
making people angry with my left-wing politics. You know, they're not really interested in hearing the political opinions.
The loudest voices are the most negative. That's just how it is.
Yeah.
But I guarantee you there are more people who are like, yeah, they just don't go out of their way.
Oh, I'm counting on the retweets. And I try to keep it good natured.
This was a huge honor, and I'm so excited to stick around and see the show. A lot of Johns on this bill. A lot of Johns. This could be the John tour.
I know. It's sick with Johns.
But thank you so much.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, my God. Thank you for having me here.
Absolutely.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Like to introduce the song is called When Will You Die?
I'm so tired of your lies and the evil things you do behind my back. Are the crimes that you have never committed? I doubt it sometimes. I wonder when will you die? children stay at home. Yeah. And all the banks will close. Yeah. Each year we'll mark the date. Yeah. On which we celebrate. I know how, I know why. I can picture every part of your comeuppance except for the remaining piece of the puzzle, which is when you'll die.
Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast was brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 15% off your new account for 6 months, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code Nerdist2. That's Nerdist and the number 2.
Are you tired of dating assholes? Do you want a Prince Charming? If so, we're filming a reality show. Sign up here.
12 American women are flown over to the UK for a bachelor-style reality dating show.
There are so many questions about a show like this because it's so odd.
These women have been told that they were going to be dating the world's most eligible bachelor, Prince Harry.
What? Y'all playing with me, right?
You can binge The Bachelor of Buckingham Palace exclusively on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts or the Wondery app.